Aloha, mud babies, pod people, and inhabitants of the planet Earth. It is I, your tiki leader, Steve Mudflap McGrew, back again for another great podcast. So put your rubber pants on and be ready to laugh a little bit. Laugh until you tinkle. Hence the rubber pants. All right, today I've got a comic friend of mine. Met him in L.A., used to work at the Ice House there. He was the door guy. Before that, a rock and roller on the L.A. scene. But now, a lot of people know him as the 420 comic. It's Jeffrey Peterson. Jeffrey's going to be here with me in just a minute, and we're going to rock and we're going to roll. Hey, I hope you had a good 4th of July. I know I did. Great fireworks show. I love the ones that are free. That's right. They're my favorite ones. The free shows. This year's finale was the best ever. But again, you know, I say that every year. And this is going to be the best podcast ever. And I say that every time, don't I? Here it is, today's podcast with Jeffrey Peterson. All right, we are finally sitting down with the recorder going. We've been sitting here talking. We should have been recording most of what we've already saying. But I'm sitting here with former L.A. comic turned Denver comic, Jeffrey Peterson. Jeff, how you doing, man?
I'm doing great, man. This is exciting.
This is your transition to Colorado now, huh?
Yeah, I feel like I've arrived now. I did feel like I arrived when I got to do the Comedy Works with you. That was a thrill because that's where it's happening.
The Comedy Works?
Yeah, I mean, that's your guys' that's the hub of comedy out here, the Comedy Works and the Denver Improv, and I'm excited to get on that level. I work a lot in the countercultural cannabis comedy community.
Hence the moniker, the 420 comic.
Yeah. You know, I wanted people to be able to differentiate me early on. And what was cool is 10 years before I ever started doing comedy, I used to be in a rock band in Burbank, California. And I would go to the supermarket and there was a guy in a suit and tie that was a comedian, but he wasn't famous. His name was George Lopez.
Yeah,
and,
yeah.
And George would see me at the supermarket all the time and he'd be like, hey, Jeff, what's up, man? You know, you can buy things other than cereal or cookies, man. I mean, get some vegetables and fruits, dude. So I would see George. And then 10 years later, when I started working at the Ice House as a door guy, George Lopez was coming through. And I told him, hey, I finally got the guts to do stand-up comedy. And he's like, hey, what kind of comedy do you do? And I said, Cheech and Chong are my idols. I want to do, you know, pot comedy like those guys, like Carlin and Cheech and Chong. And he's like, man, you stick to that. And then when Cheech and Chong are done, they're going to hand you the keys, man.
And so, he was pretty much right. I mean, you're on the right track. But didn't you just recently open for Cheech and Chong?
I did. I opened for Cheech and Chong at the Fillmore, the famous Fillmore Auditorium downtown. And that was a real thrill. I worked with Sister Sledge and Family Stone.
Opening? God, what a 70s themed show.
Yeah, good thing I was around in the 70s to know what was up.
Yeah.
But the neat thing was, you know, opening for Cheech and Chong wasn't nearly as cool as rapping with those guys backstage, because I got such a one-on-one experience with Cheech and Chong. And what was neat is I had met Tommy several times before that. I was on his radar. I used to write to him when he was in prison and stuff. And yeah, I would send him comic books.
Dear
and,
Tommy,
yeah.
I wish you weren't in prison.
You know what was great is the day he got out, this was when MySpace was around, he friend requested me on MySpace and said, dude, I got every letter and I really appreciate it. And just what a heck of a nice guy, especially for someone that I idolized so much. But Tommy kind of sensed that Cheech and I never really, like, hung out with each other. So he literally got up and let Cheech and I hang out. And I was sitting there doing Gary Busey impressions and Martin Scorsese impressions for Cheech and Chong for Cheech.
Was he into it?
He was like, way into it. I told him that I do Gary Busey on Frasier's show. And he was like, oh man, I want to hear it. And I'm like, hey, look, Cheech, we got to talk about this, man. And he goes, damn, that sounds just like him. And then I told him, you know, my favorite, one of my favorite Cheech and Chong movies is not a Cheech and Chong movie. It's After Hours by Martin Scorsese.
And I know the movie. What
Cheech and Chong played Neil and Pepe, the two guys that were going around stealing stuff. And I told Cheech, I used to do a bit in my act about, Martin Scorsese directing Cheech and Chong, but not very many people know what Martin Scorsese sounds like. So Cheech is like, well, let me hear it. And I go, okay, in this scene, you are not two stoners from the San Fernando Valley of California. No. In this scene, you're two hard-nosed criminals from the hard-nosed streets of New York City. All right, roll them. Not a joint, Tommy. That's the camera. And Cheech goes, that's exactly what he sounded like, man.
That's pretty good.
Yeah.
Because a lot of people don't really know what Martin Scorsese sounds like. But that's pretty much it right there. So how many impressions do you do? Have you counted how many that you do?
Somebody brought me up on stage once, said the man of 420 voices. So including dialects and you know, cartoon impressions and just different ethnic impressions and celebrities. I probably do well over 100 impressions.
So not a man of 1,000 voices, man of 100.
Yeah.
But now, you know what? That's really good. Because think of most impressionists that you know, they only have like 5 or 6.
Right.
I mean, even the famous ones that you can think of, you know, like,
yeah.
And here is me doing, you know, Jimmy Stewart, or here I am doing.
Right. I do.
Christopher Walken.
In my act. I try to stay away from. I only do them because they're fun. And working in Vegas, as we do, they love impressions in Vegas and they go over great. So if I can pull out my Ice T, yeah, I'll tell mofo, yo, this is Ice T from Body Count. You know, or I'll pull out, I like to do Al Pacino, baby, yeah, hoo-ha. I will do Al Pacino as though he was in the movie The Big Lebowski. So I do different stuff. I used to do on Frasier's show. I used to call in regularly as James Gandolfini. Frasier, what the heck is wrong with you? I'm standing here with Steve Buscemi. I'm supposed to have tickets for Van Halen. I got told to wet Sprocket. You know. So I just love impressions. And what's funny is and you know a lot of these guys. I love doing impressions of comedians who aren't famous.
Right. Who give you now? Go ahead.
I like to do Greg Wilson's one of my favorite. Hey, you guys, come on. You guys want a party or what? We should do some coke, you guys. Come on, man.
And everybody that knows Greg Wilson goes, that's right on.
Yeah.
But other people are going,
who the heck is
Greg
that?
Greg Wilson.
And I used to call Frasier all the time as Brian Scolaro. Frasier, you know what I mean? What the hell's going on? I could be in New York City right now. I could be at Gotham. But, you know, no, I got to be here at Pasadena in front of a bunch of Mexicans. This is awful. Yeah.
Jeff Garcia, yeah, you know, I got stabbed. Yeah, I got, yeah. Okay, dude. All right, thank you, dude. I got stabbed. I don't do a Steve McGrew yet, but.
Oh. Well, it sounds a lot like this. I think a lot of just have to just talk like Mr. Haney.
Yeah, Mr.
Mr. Douglas. And now there's people in their 20s going, who is he talking about? That's the other thing I figured out in comedy. You really have to stay on top of your references.
Yeah.
You really have to pay attention because as times change and audiences change, you don't think about the fact that it's not a reference that everybody knows.
I know. And it's really weird because as we get older, they get younger. And what's bizarre is I have found that if my target audience is just a little bit older than me, if I'm 46, so if I get somebody that went through the 60s or the 70s, they're gonna love all my references.
Right.
But when I get in front of these like opening for a band like Cottonmouth Kings, there's 19, 17, you know, 22-year-olds there. I got to get hip quick.
Right.
And it actually takes a little bit of thought, you know.
So do you keep up with things for the younger people? Do you try to stay on top of the reference? Because I have a friend, and you may know him too, Bobby Gaylor
was okay.
A comic in L.A., who's now a writer, and he's mm-hmm. on Phineas and Ferb. But he told me to stay on top of new references. He just calls younger
all right,
people.
Grab the dog.
Yeah, she just does says, almost hey, every podcast.
What do y'all call pants now? She wants to be in it.
You know,
she
is.
I mean, you seriously
either,
have to, and it's what's
hear
weird
in the background,
is,
or you hear on the floor,
it's difficult to hang around
with the cats.
People that age because it's pretty darn cute.
It's like,
I can feel kind of out of touch.
God made her that way, so
I'm surprised that I do. But
that's a good defense so mechanism.
And it, what I find, so especially
back
because
to the 420
I work
comic,
in
the, who is
the cannabis
now
community,
in the 420
I'm not
state.
A big hip hop guy,
yeah.
And hip hop is
here
so
big
huge.
You
know,
the
so I don't know
weed,
the hip hop references.
I
so I
gotta
get
Colorado.
Schooled on.
I'd be lying
Blunt
if I didn't say it was
and,
love.
Yeah,
and there's so much terminology too with that, like specific.
She was a Las Vegas native.
I have to be on point. Like I'm doing.
She had just
speakeasy
had it.
Vape lounge
even though,
on Thursday.
You know
have
what
to
a,
have
after the after the show's done.
Yes. References
that town
to their
is
lifestyle.
Pretty sleazy.
Right. Or you have to do a little research.
Uh-huh.
Do a little,
it can be
second.
Very
I'm
hopeless
grab that dog and
on
shut
a day to day.
Barking dog up, up here, right?
After the lights go down and the glamour's gone. And it's just hot as hell. It's just literally, it's like 122 degrees
on over, a regular basis.
Yeah. And that gets to you. So she had made plans to, while we were going out, she said, I'd already kind of been thinking of going somewhere else and restarting my life. And luckily she said Denver, because if she would have said Iowa, I would have said goodbye, Iowa, because there ain't nothing for me there. But when she said Denver, it was the perfect logical conclusion for me to blaze a new trail, pun intended. And honestly, the appeal of the fact that you lived out here and Chris Fonseca, I realized it could be done.
It's a great comedy scene. That's what I mean. As you know from living here, and you're reading, and like we've got the new guys that are coming up, like Ben Roy and
Nathan Lund and
these guys
and Chuck Roy
and Andy Jewett, these guys that are making a new comedy scene.
Yeah,
and I think we sort of did it in the early days. There was a different comedy scene, but I think these guys are kicking it up to the next level.
Yeah,
there's a whole new. And it probably is because of the internet and the possibilities of what you can do. You don't have to go to Hollywood to put a show out.
Yeah.
And I think that's what they're finally seeing now. It's like, hey, we can record here, we can tape here, we can produce here.
Yeah, and this is becoming a very media savvy city. The neat thing is when I saw Cheech and Chong with War recently, the first thing that Tommy Chong said when he got on the mic was, "Wow, man, I'm moving to Colorado." And I beat you to it, dude. I'm already here. So, and Tommy's son, Paris, lives in, where does he live? Boulder. So, or I'm not sure, Pueblo or Boulder, but
those are two different, completely
exactly.
different.
I think Boulder, but there's people coming here from all over, and I've yet to explore. I've never been to Boulder yet. I've never been.
You haven't?
I've not been to Fort
you
Collins.
Have, you have not been to Colorado
I know.
Yet. If you haven't been,
and that's what's exciting is it's all there for me. I've had a great time in Colorado Springs, checking that out, and I've been out to Golden and stuff. And like I told you, Monday is my first show ever at Red Rocks. I've been, ever since I saw you two at Red Rocks when I was a kid, I wanted to go there. So this is a great place. And the neat thing too is now that I'm stationed, you know, my headquarters are here in Denver, to the outside world, when I travel to California, or I'm going to be in New Hampshire next week for a hemp fest, saying you're from Denver really has a great ring to it, because now people see
you are hip.
Yeah, it's like
you are now.
It's like the way I'm introduced in Vegas is, this guy loves weed so much he moved to Denver. You know, so which is true, because I really do like living a lifestyle without worrying about breaking the law and getting in trouble. I mean, I've got a Colorado state ID that says I'm allowed to carry an ounce of cannabis on me legally at any time, and as long as I'm not disturbing others, I'm cool.
Well, I have to. I've always thought it's no big deal, and but when your neighbor gets high, and your whole house smells like pot all the time, then you go, "All right, is this a good thing?" Or,
well, I got to get real. You have cats, and my neighbors have cats, and my apartment building smells like cat piss every time I walk out. It's a weird give and take. I've done some stuff in Canada. I was in Toronto in 2010. I headlined their first ever cannabis festival. It was called the Treating Yourself Expo. And what was neat about that was Canadians have a real easy approach to cannabis. They treat it like it's a cigar. If it bothers you, you either walk away or you ask someone, would you mind, you know, going over there?
Yeah.
And that's about as much of an inconvenience as it should be. Now, I mean, obviously, to Colorado's credit, look at this. 6 months as a testing ground, they've made over $10 million in taxable revenue.
Right.
That has already gone to schools, roads, highways, and the infrastructure. So, I mean, it's really hard to argue with that kind of logic. I mean, it doesn't make sense anymore that it's a detriment when it can really save an economy.
Well, for you, and I've known you for years, you work well with the pot.
Yeah.
You can be high and have a good time, but don't you know people that just get high and are wastoids?
Yes, I do.
And just wastoids. And that was the one thing that was scared me because I knew so many people in school, in high school and stuff like that, that just became total losers because of it. They weren't able to figure out that you can work with this, or this can enhance scenery, or this can help your art, or it wasn't just about let's get stoned and lay in our room. It was like motivation killers to young people.
Well, you know, being part of the activist community, activism, I mean, it's a verb. It's you have to be in motion and perpetually. And the thing is, we have an obligation sort of to the larger community to show them that cannabis isn't a motivation and detriment. It's more of an enhancement if you really let it. I mean, I belong to a group of highly motivated stoners. They're filmmakers, they're musicians that make tons of money, they're comedians, they're writers and artists and cultivators and culinary geniuses. There's people, they're really excited about this culture, so we keep it vibrant. The ones that are lazy, they're going to fall by the wayside, and they never represented us anyways. So.
But then we got to start taking care of them.
Yeah.
Then we got to start putting them on food stamps. Well, and then we got...
Well, you know, Steve, really what we should be concerned with, and this is going to sound like surprising to a lot of people, is this new generation of young people that are doing the concentrates, the dabbing. And mm-hmm. I don't know if you know what that is. These oils are highly concentrated cannabis.
Yeah, I talked to Hippie Man.
John
Novosad about that. He goes, because, you know,
he made his eyes straight. Yeah.
Well, that's what he was telling me. He goes, I've been, you know, for years, I've been, and he goes, this shit will knock you on your ass.
It will, and it will highly demotivate you. And I've noticed a lethargy kind of pattern with this younger generation. They're all dabbed out, man. So you got to do another dab, and it's like, that low energy vibe is not where it's at. You know what's ironic is my mentor Vic Dunlop, our buddy, the late great Vic Dunlop, when he helped me structure how to get out there, one recommendation he gave me I did not take. He told me, you need to develop a stoner voice like Tommy Chong and go out there and be like, hey man, what's up you guys? He goes, because
that's the stereotypical.
He said
stoner.
You got to dumb it down. He goes, your vocabulary, your vernacular is above your audience. And I said, and I'm going to keep it that way, because
you want to raise the audience,
right?
Up.
And I know that there is a certain type of intellectual stoner or just everyday person that's going to get where I'm coming from.
Yeah.
So I never dumbed it down, and I said I appreciate that, but I'm not going to be Gilbert Gottfried and trapped in a voice,
right?
Because Gilbert doesn't really talk like this. We know that Gilbert Gottfried is stuck in a voice that he can't get out.
But he's making millions.
He is. But, I mean...
Look at Larry the Cable Guy. Yeah. There's the same thing. He's going to be trapped in doing that forever.
You know what's you got to admit, this is the dumbest idea. Larry the Cable Guy, health inspector. You're already a cable guy. How the hell do you get to be a health inspector? Right? Wait a minute. My cable guy is...
checking the meat in the restaurant?
Get her done. I got several jobs, man. I like Prilosec OT. Larry the Cable Guy, rock star. Come on, man. I can do it all.
He can play a truck. He can do anything.
True. True. I auditioned years and years and years ago for... It was at the time, you know, nobody had ever heard of it. It was for Lion King.
Uh-huh.
And now, you know, what a massive hit it was. But I auditioned for the pig. Yeah. Was it Pumbaa?
Yeah.
And only because of the pig thing I used to do in my act. You know?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
And,
you got
and
that.
And there was no that. But I never realized who in casting at Disney said, you should have this guy come in and read. Because I'm not a voice guy. I'm not a typical. I have trouble.
If Charlotte's Webbs comes back, you're in, man.
Really?
You can play Wilbur the Pig. I auditioned. I think I told you this. I used to be in animation for many years. That was my background. I directed mouth movements for cartoons on the X-Men, Batman, Fantastic Four, My Little Pony. I mean, it was a family business. My brother worked on Fat Albert, and my aunt created.
Hey, this is Fat Albert. I just want to say to the guys in the Junkyard Gang, I'm not fat, okay? This is the glandular problem, okay? I got diabetes. Would y'all get off my back?
That would be the new version of Fat Albert. Yeah. He'd have problems, and you'd have to understand.
Hey, and Weird Harold, stop masturbating in the clubhouse.
Sheba. Who was he? That
was Mushmouth.
That was my favorite.
Hey, Bogob. Wubba Huben. And, man, they were weird. But I actually auditioned for some voiceovers at a time when there was a strike. I swooped in there because you know how tight knit those are.
I know a lot of the voiceover guys. A couple guys that went in for The Simpsons that I were trying to read for The Simpsons. Another was reading for Tony the Tiger or something
right.
like that.
We were people were swooping in trying to get there, and it was like a little 2-week window. So I went in there to Sue Blue and I did, "Hello, Kermit the Frog here for the Muppet Babies," and they went, "That's it, you're Kermit, you're in." I'm like, really? They're like, yeah, you're in. A week later, the strike was over.
That's it. You're out.
Same thing happened. I auditioned for Felix the Cat, radio. And they said, you're it. You're the new Felix. I'm like, this is it. And then they go, oh, I'm sorry. Yeah, we got to honor our contracts.
But doesn't that seem to be the way of showbiz that mm-hmm. you're in and you're out? I mean, how many times have you gotten close to something? I even quit telling people that things are going to happen anymore. Because,
I don't.
You know, you sign for this and then it doesn't happen. You write a script and it gets bought, but it doesn't get produced. You're like, this industry just, it basically just kicks you around until you die or give up.
Don't believe it until you're there. Because over the last 10 years, I have told people I'm opening for Cheech and Chong at least 4 times that didn't
finally
happen.
Finally happened. Finally going
to
happen.
Then it finally really happened. And you know what? When that happened, I really downplayed it until it happened. I was like, I'm just going to let this see what happens here. But here's an interesting story about something that could have happened that didn't. My number one destination on Earth is Australia. I'd give up everything just to go on a walkabout for 2 months and just explore Australia, the culture, I try not to get killed out there by the snakes and the spiders, but I really dig everything. AC/DC, the music of Midnight Oil, NXS, all that stuff.
Right.
The actors and stuff. So I wanted to be in Australia so bad that in 2004, I auditioned for the Crocodile Hunter Challenge. Steve Irwin had a new show where you could live at the Australia Zoo in a reality TV show challenge. But you had to interact with the crocodiles and stuff. And they said, would you mind holding snakes? And I'm like, not at all. I don't care. I want to go to Australia. And they said, why? And I said, because I love everything about it. I love Men at Work. I love Rick Springfield.
I love Vegemite. Yeah,
Mad Max is one of my favorite movies. I said, I want to go on Ayers Rock. I want to swim in the Great Barrier Reef. And they're like, you know a lot about Australia, don't you? And I'm like, I'm an Australian trapped in an American's body. And they called me up a week later and said, you know, we've spoken to over 5,000 people in America. And of those 5,000 people, you exemplify what this show is about. We'd like to meet you at the Four Seasons Hotel in Beverly Hills to discuss you being on the show. They told me of the 5,000 people they met, I was the number one candidate. I'm on the show with my long hair and everything. They said, you're it. You are our first cast member. 2 weeks later, Steve Irwin died. He got bit by that man.
Oh, yeah, stabbed by that stingray.
I started crying. I was like, oh, my God. I mean, I was partially sad for him, but I was like, oh, there goes my chance. So I still have the audition paper. It was at the Comedy Store. I auditioned, and I didn't get it, but I can feel in my heart they said I was the number one candidate.
You got it. In your heart. In your heart, you got it.
It was better than when Ross Mark... there's Ross Mark and what's the other guy's name on Last Comic? There's the two guys.
Oh, I don't know. I hadn't...
Well, I auditioned for that the second season. I think it was Ross Mark told me, because he still keeps in touch with me. He said, "You're very funny. Do you write your own material?" I said, "Yes." He goes, "I want to see you at the Improv tonight." The other producer goes, "You need a shave and a haircut. Goodbye." And that was it. And then the next season, Josh Blue wins. And I was like,
"What? Man, he needed a shave and a haircut.
How is Jay London and Josh Blue getting away with this? I'm just as Neanderthal as those dudes. Come on, man."
Yeah, I don't know about that show.
Yeah.
It keeps changing the rules. I know it's evolved over time, but remember at first you had to be undiscovered, and then you couldn't have any yeah. credits, and then you could have credits, but then they didn't want, you know, this and that. And
let's face it, the beginning was the best because, you know, our friend Terry Joyce was on it, Ralphie May, people like that on the first season, and Jeff Brown, I remember. They made them live together.
Right. They had it was like a Big Brother comedy thing.
And that's where the funny was, watching Corey Kahaney and Terry Joyce argue in a kitchen. That was neat stuff for me. And then the weird challenges they made them do, like, now you're going to go entertain a group of six-year-olds. That was really hard for a lot of those comics.
Not only hard, that really stupid.
They're really stupid. Really stupid. Because, yeah, when are you going to have to do
ever.
That?
In your career as a comic, ever. Yeah. That, you know, do you ever find yourself like not wanting to do a gig or turning down a gig because you find it's a situation like this? Like
I have
what
kids I wouldn't mind doing, but I've had some gigs go really sour. Like I did the Newhall Highway Patrol one time out in California, and they let me know right away they hated me, and the cops surrounded me right when they were all drunk off duty cops, and they surrounded me. And told me to my face they hate me, and I'll be lucky if I make it to my car.
Wow. Did you do something or say something? Or
I just did my material, which has a lot to do with cannabis and the fact that I was raised by lesbians. And I could tell that their chief of police or whatever, the captain,
uh-huh.
was a lesbian who was not out of the closet. And they were that was the
You ice. Said this to them? In the show?
I started doing my material about being raised by lesbians, and I could tell everybody in the room, they looked over at her like I was breaking a big taboo. But it was a pretty I wasn't really scared.
Wait, hold on. you say this is just the way that I hear it. Raised by lesbians. Mm-hmm. Much like I was raised by wolves.
That's pretty much what
you,
it was like.
You kind of say it with the same kind. Oh. I was raised by lesbians.
Yeah, this is the 70s, gang. This is, you know, these weren't lipstick lesbians. They were wearing flannel.
And oh, I mean, really?
Yeah, they short hair, flannel. You know, it was like having two dads, my two dads. You know, it was tough on Mother's Day to go down to the men's department at Sears and get two pairs of overalls. That's not easy. You know, and... everybody knew I had two moms but me when I was a little kid. I mean, the mailman knew, the UPS guy, even the Avon lady's like, is your mother at home? No, she's at work. Is your other mother at home? You're like, what?
So, and you're like, have you seen them? Yeah. They don't want Avon. Is that what you were?
Yeah, and I didn't have, nowadays kids have like Ellen DeGeneres and Portia de Rossi, all these cool role models. The only role models I had were Laverne and Shirley. That was tough.
Having not knowing this story well, is one your actual mom, or were you adopted?
It gets weird.
Okay.
It gets even weirder, I should say. Not only was I living with two lesbians, but this was in a Crips neighborhood in West LA.
Okay.
We were the minorities, and I would wonder, why are we living in the hood? Well, where else do minorities live? Because in the 70s, West Hollywood wasn't like hip. It was like, it was still taboo to be gay.
Right.
And so I was raised by these two moms, one of which was my actual mom. The other was my aunt. And you know how it's weird, like if your mom gets divorced and then she's got a new boyfriend, it's Uncle Chuck?
You're right.
This actually was my Aunt Karen. My mom left my dad for his sister.
Wait.
Is that a Jerry Springer moment or
Jerry, Jerry.
That was bizarre.
How did that go over with the whole entire family?
Not that well. It was kind of weird. And I have three older brothers, and I was the only guy that went through this experience. I was like the expendable one. My dad's like, yeah, I'll send the kid. I remember getting dropped off at Blythe, California at that Chevron there, and like, there you go, take the kid. And so I was then, you know, raised by wolves by these two lesbians. And it wasn't. You know, it wasn't nearly as hip as people think. And I've wanted to tell Rosie O'Donnell and some other people that, you know, were interested in this subject that, you know, there's another side to being raised in a gay household. Everybody thinks it's just two loving people. It's perfect.
Yeah. Well, every child just needs right. a couple. It doesn't matter, right?
There's just as much capacity for violence and dysfunction in a gay household. And I'll tell you what, if you know anything about women, put two of them together in a household in a relationship, that is insanity.
And let them cycle together.
The worst part was we had a cat in the house. We had a cat that I literally, the entire time I was a kid, could not pet the cat. The cat would run from me. You know what kind of message this sends to a little boy living in a gay household? Pussy is off limits in this house. So I took that to the bank. But what was neat is my mom ended up being she passed away 12 years ago, but she ended up being a celebrity nanny for Steven Seagal,
uh-huh.
Clint Eastwood. She raised Clint Eastwood's daughter, Francesca, for 9 years, and now Francesca is a reality TV star. Scott Bakula, Tom Hanks, a bunch of people. So
she had some raising skills.
She had some she certainly put them to use after.
All the mistakes she made with you, she yeah. learned from.
I was like, at least she raised Hollywood right. But it was great. I would get, you know, I'd be like 16 years old and I'd get phone calls from Clint Eastwood. It'd be like, is Carol there? And I'd be like, oh my God, it's dirty hair. But the neat thing was Steven Seagal would call, and I thought Steven Seagal was a real jerk. And he is.
He is. Indeed.
So he'd call and go, is Carol there? And I'd go, what are you, a tough guy? He'd go, excuse me? And I go, Mom.
Mom.
But I actually hit it off with Scott Bakula. Scott Bakula is a great guy. And he took
I've always thought so. He always seems
super
cool.
Super nice guy. Took me on the set of Quantum Leap. Me and my two stoner friends introduced us to Dean Stockwell. Bob Saget happened to be on that show. And we know Bob Saget is lightning in a bottle.
Right.
Bob Saget sensed that me and my two friends got stoned while we were on the set, and he proceeded to annihilate us just with his machine gun wit and had us like laughing so hard they had to like stop a take. And they're like, Bob, stop telling jokes to these kids.
We tried to do something over here.
And then the producer came up to us shortly afterwards, came up to me and said, are you smoking pot on my set? I said, me? I'm like 17. And I go, no. And he goes, security guard said he smelt some pot in a room he went into. He said, no, we smelt some pot in a room. We followed him. We thought he was smoking it. And Scott Bakula was so, like, such a gentleman and so nice. Two takes later, Scott came up and he said, you guys had a good time, didn't you, today? And I would go, yeah. And he goes, thanks for coming. You guys are great. I'm so glad you got to see us work. And, you know, I think we're about done here. But thanks, guys.
Like he tried to send you on your way.
He did. He sent us on our way, but he didn't mention anything. And so, true gentleman to this day, but had to do it. I mean, I'm on the set of Quantum Leap. If I couldn't tell this story, it would have been a lot more boring.
I've always thought a really good actor. He's one of those guys that's maintained a career.
Yeah.
You know, just didn't do Quantum Leap and disappear.
Or
what was it, Major League? Didn't he? Yeah, that movie, the baseball movie.
He was in Unnecessary Roughness.
Unnecessary Roughness, that's
played
it.
He played the quarterback.
That's right.
You know,
that was comedy sports movies.
Yeah, and he's also, he was, for a minute there, he was the captain of the Enterprise. So
true.
He was the captain before Captain Kirk, so that's kind of neat, you know.
Which one was he? Because I've lost track of all the Star Trek, Star Trek, Next Generation, Star Trek.
His name was Captain Archer, and it was for the TV show Enterprise.
Enterprise
was like supposed to be like the, I guess in the 20th century still, or the 21st century still, where it was supposed to be like in, you know, like 21 something or something, like 22nd century.
And what was the one where the chick was the captain?
That was Deep Space Nine.
Deep Space Nine.
What I always thought is weird is how can we like FaceTime somebody on a wristwatch like Dick Tracy, yet Captain Kirk couldn't even see Scotty when he called him? I mean, what's up with that? It's the 23rd century. That's kind of screwy. Kirk to Enterprise. I can't see you, Scotty. Where the hell are you?
It's like, but they could beam somebody down. They couldn't have a picture on their tricorder.
I mean, how can they view space and inside someone else's, like, you know, the Romulans can talk to them, but they can't talk on their...
You're looking for the loopholes. Yeah. See, you're destroying... I just had this conversation last night with the girlfriend. We were on our other podcast because she likes Under the Dome, the show Under the Dome. And if I see little loopholes and things, I point them out. You know, like, if this is happening, linear thinking, this should happen. Like, if nails are flying out of the wall because of an electromagnet, shouldn't everything magnet be flying out? Shouldn't your teeth be flying out of your head? If you could pull a nail out of a... She's like, stop it. Just stop picking it to pieces.
I know. It's like you start pulling the thread away. Like, Batman couldn't have done that. No way.
Right. Yeah.
But then, you know... It is supposed to be fantasy, so it's like, you know.
But they give you just enough on TV. Like, they don't want to go overboard with special effects.
Yeah.
Or could that be too pricey? They'll just give you enough to give you a hint of the illusion of what, you know. Oh, look, a bicycle and a barbecue pit flew by because of the magnetic. And then, but yet, whole other things aren't just zooming by at 1,000 miles an hour. You just get a hint of magnetism.
Right. We didn't think that far ahead. Just keep watching.
So if you could do any show for yourself, what would you have? Has somebody come to you and said, create a show for yourself? Do you have a show in mind of what the...
I do. Terry Joyce and I created a show back in 2006 called The Dope Show, which evolved into what is now the dopest show on earth. And it's my cannabis comedy variety show. And I would love to see that, like, on Comedy Central or a live tour, because it's stand-up comedy, it's musical acts, and usually some bizarre, you know, contortionist or some weird costumed character or just something outside the box. Just almost like a... do you know Jen Kober, the comedian?
Yeah.
Jen did our show one time, and, you know, she's a big... big robust southern lesbian, like totally out lesbian, and we're getting stoned after the show, me and Terry, her, and she goes, man, I just got what your show's about, man. You guys are like hee-haw on weed. And I'm like, that's exactly what we are.
I just got it.
Yeah, I just got it after she did it. And that's kind of what we have been. And I mean, over the years in the show, we've had, you know, Mo Collins and Brad Williams and people like Adam Hunter, who are now on the Tonight Show, and just like Owen Benjamin, Ben Glebe, all these people have like
passed through.
Yeah, they've evolved. Like, when I look at my roster of people I've had over the years and the last 8 years, it's amazing. So I really foresee this being a traveling circus kind of thing where I can take this to different towns, and I really want to take it to the red states. I want to take it to these states that don't have cannabis knowledge. Use the medium of comedy to open the door to a conversation,
right?
You know, and then what I've done over the years is had, in the midst of the comedy, I'll have a speaker come up for 5 minutes and drop some science, and then while you, because if you're laughing, you're thinking, and you know, it's a short window. Stoners have about a 90-minute attention span. Before
the show's over,
even
in their
if you
head.
Provide food for them and everything they need, they're gonna.
Unless you're
off.
A jam band,
unless
and
you're
then,
a jam,
and then you can play for 6 hours, or you play for 4 and they complain.
Yeah, exactly. Like I remember Dave Chappelle one time. I was at the Comedy Store, and he did a 4-hour and 30-minute set, and he said, "I don't care how much you like Dave Chappelle. You think you like Dave Chappelle, but I'm gonna walk you." You will leave before I'm finished saying things. And lo and behold, an hour and a half, I'm like, I wake up and I go, well, that's about enough Dave Chappelle for me.
Well, I just don't know how anybody does that. The longest even I ever did was 2 hours and 15 minutes. I just wanted to try one night just to see. Mm-hmm. And I quit at 2:15 because I couldn't think of anything more that I wanted to say or that I thought was really funny. Because I don't want to, you wouldn't want to just stand there and not be funny.
Right.
But then when I came off stage, I started thinking of to myself, oh, I didn't do this, and I didn't do this, and I could have done, but there's no reason to be up there that long.
Right. It's not, I mean, I just pulled something off in California that was pretty funny. In North Hollywood, I did the Marijuana-thon, 4 hours and 20 minutes of pot comedy. And I had some great names from the LA comedy scene in there. Mike Moratori and Richard Chasler, a bunch of old school people, Perry Kurtz, all these people. And I had to turn comedians away. 4 hours and 20 minutes. And I had a room the whole time, and it was people coming in and out and stuff like that. But you know, if we're doing it right, there we should hurt people's guts so much, which I know for a fact you do, that after like 90 minutes,
I'm done.
It almost hurts too much to laugh.
Right, and I've actually, it's funny you say that, and I appreciate that. I actually had somebody tell me that on a ship last week.
Yeah,
that I laughed so hard, I had to stop.
Uh huh.
And I go, well, you're not supposed to stop. You're not supposed to, but they had just kind of laughed themselves out.
Yeah, because, I mean, we're really using these abdomen muscles to laugh. And, I mean, for some people, that's the most they've laughed and
you we're know, a weight loss program.
Yeah, we are. We are. And, you know, it's cool, man. I mean, it's what we do is so therapeutic. And you know, sometimes we're in a shitty mood, and we got to go up and be funny. And people don't realize that is not easy. To like, you know, you may have just gotten an argument with your girlfriend on the ride over, and you're like, it's okay, now I got to snap into this and be funny.
Right.
Or, you know what I
mean?
Well,
it's a one-man play. I think that's what, in my head, I always think about it, I have to do this no matter what. And I'll get up there, and I'll say this like it's the very first time I've ever said
it.
And a lot of times, it is. Yeah. Because I don't ever write anything out. I don't know how you are. If you write out a set, I just go up and just start talking.
I write a set, but I smoke so much pot. I'll go, dude, what the hell's wrong with you? You didn't even stick to it. And you know what I hate is when I think I'm writing down a set, and then in the middle of it, I'll realize you're not sticking to your set. You're veering off. I gotta catch myself.
Is it hurting your show? No,
it's not. But I sometimes I don't know if you've ever done this, but I sometimes feel like I could have gone a different direction, and I almost wish I would have talked about this material instead
longer.
Of, you know, like I try not to do too much pot related material, because then people will just write me off, pigeonhole me. It's like, that's all I can do.
Right.
That's why the impressions come in handy, because people are like, oh, I didn't know you do that. And I do a bunch of one liners, and I've had people even say, you know, why don't you just do just one-liners? And I'm like, because I want to have fun and do it all, you know?
Don't pigeonhole yourself.
Mm-hmm.
It's kind of like when you see a fat comic do a fat show the entire time.
Right.
Or you do
an urban show where it's like, black people are like this the whole time. Every time, every joke I'm going to do is about black people being like this. You know, it's like, that gets old.
Right.
We can't relate. It's about relating to each other.
Right, and I think that's what it's probably you figured it out, that you come out and you can do a little bit of this, and this is who I am,
mm-hmm.
and this is another act.
Yeah,
it's kind of like when you come out and say, "All right, I'm from this town, I have this kind of relatives, and this is the way I look at life, and now I'm gonna take out a little trip."
Yeah,
so they get a background of who you are and a sense of who you are, but that's not your entire show. So, is there any chance you may put together that pot show here in Colorado, the dopest show on earth? Are y'all gonna do it here?
Yeah, I actually have done it here four times. I did it twice at a place called iBake, which is right on the over the border. I'm not sure like what county it's in, but it's just outside of Denver, so they're able to have this kind of show there. It was a comedy show, variety show where people could imbibe legally right in front of you. So I did that was kind of my debut of the dopest show on earth out here. I did two shows, and they back to back, two nights in a row, it went great. And then I've also taken it to a place called the Hood Lab out here, which is a clothing store in
downtown Denver that has
a clothing store that does comedy.
Yeah, that does comedy and big, huge fashion shows and DJ events. Hood Lab is also in San Francisco, so they're pretty big.
But, well, you started, we talked about this a little earlier, in L.A., and so you're used to doing kind of bizarre places of comedy. Like, what was the place I told you, the Black Angus that I did, and you said you started in a Denny's.
Marie Callender's.
Marie Callender's, but you did a Denny's show,
I did a Denny's,
And I think in L.A., and it's starting to be here, is anywhere that'll put up a microphone, people will perform.
Yeah.
Because you look at L.A., and they're like, I'm at such and such coffee house, you know, and there's... That's not even big enough for comedy, but they have a comedy night.
Yeah, it's...
Do you like places like that, or do you just get used to working places like that?
Well, ideally, there's nothing beats being in a comedy club, because people know why they're there. They're going to get their money's worth. They want to laugh.
The focus is on comedy.
It's on comedy. So anytime you take comedy and shove it in another venue, it's already a little difficult, but... It's also very challenging and very fun. And I'm very much into not just traditional comedy, but really the craft of comedy in places where it might not belong. Like the Burning Man Festival that's been going around for 29 years now in Nevada. I went there 12 years and I did comedy there for 5. And I mean,
how was that?
That is just bizarre, being in front of 300, and I had my own show every single day in our center camp, which is like the downtown. There's 80,000 people at Burning Man for a week. At any given moment, there'd be about 300 people in front of me, and it was nuts because they could be on ecstasy, LSD, shrooms. They could
Molly was on Molly.
Yeah, exactly. You know, like I'd say, you know, I don't know about you guys, but I've been rolling on Molly all night. At least that's what the girl told me her name was. It's funny to do comedy for such a counterculture is bizarre, because half the time you don't know if they're really into it. They're just staring at you and laughing internally. But then you get a guy that run up later. Hey, man. Hey, come here, man. I just want to tell you. That thing you were saying about lesbians is hilarious, bro. So, you know,
it affect your timing, though? I guess that's where I was going to go with this, because I've done one pot show so far here in town. We did it at the Comedy Works. It was It was a roast of the pot roast, it was called.
Yeah. Oh, that sounds delicious.
I know. And I could tell that the timing was slightly off.
It is.
It was just slightly.
They internalized. Stoners internalized. Like something with you, you'd be talking about, the dog food you'd feed your dog, Yukonuba and stuff like that. A stoner will sit there and internalize that and go, oh, man, I love my dog. My dog's cool. And they'll veer off on what you just said.
Right.
Or they'll think, Yukonuba, I should get my dog some dog food.
So they miss
the next joke. And I've had my show in Hollywood before, one show where I had like Jeff Richards and Jen Murphy and a bunch of people. I remember Jen Murphy, who's a headliner, came up to me and said, they didn't like my stuff. They're not getting it. They're not laughing. I said, oh, trust me, they're laughing. They loved you. And she's like, they didn't even laugh. And then all these people came up to her later and were like, you're so funny. And she goes, well, how come you weren't laughing? They were going, oh, we were laughing on the inside, man. They're just, stoners are shy. They're like, they just kind of like think.
I just don't understand how you could, how you feel like I'm on the right subject. Should I, because you know, at a club, if you get a laugh, you can, I'm staying on this. I'm going to talk a little longer. I'm going to veer off because they're liking this topic. But if you just have people that are, do you ever get like, your wheels feel like I'm just spinning here? Do they like me? Should I stay on this? Should I move along? Should I?
No, because I think like Tommy Chong, I speak their language. I think it's, and I've seen other comedians that, you know, for example, I did a show at the John Lovitz Comedy Club. It was a cannabis autism benefit. And I was the headliner over Jeff Garcia, who's a television headliner. He's much bigger than me in the world of comedy. And I went up after Jeff Garcia and I got a standing ovation. I crushed. And Jeff after the show goes, man, those stoners love you, dude. Man, they really dig your stuff. And I said, hey, if we were at the Ice House, it'd be those Mexicans love you, dude. So, and not that they don't love me, because I have my Latino material too. But the thing is, that was my audience.
my voice was the one that spoke to them. And sometimes you just see where your target audience is. And I've seen other great comics be too high on stage and kind of bomb because they...
Because they're too high.
They're too high. And they like they stepped into an arena they really shouldn't have.
Well, you said something that just kind of sparked something in me. Is do you see in this day and age of a breakdown of niche audiences? Because you said like, hey, I've got this and I've got my Mexicans at that. Mm-hmm. And I've got, and I sort of noticed this now too, is that it used to just be comedy. It mm-hmm. would just go to the comedy club and comedy. But now it has to be, you know, Latino night or urban night or pot night or it's a hip hop night or it has to be.
It's compartmentalized. Yeah,
it's getting very much like.
That's why I saw the cannabis comedy thing as a genre. Because, you know, there was gay comedy, there was Asian comedy nights, there's, you know, I've done urban comedy nights. I started at the Comedy Union, that was one of the places in LA, and I did Chocolate Sundays for 6 years, and I think I hold the record as the graduate. Like, they never moved me up. It's like, and I was such an oddity, like, I'm out, like, there's a white boy on stage. Like, so, you know, but then funny is funny.
That's what I find, too.
That's what's great about this business is after I did rock and roll for years, I mean, I started doing comedy at 35, and I thought, what can I seriously do, like, to reinvent myself? I can either become a country music singer or become a comedian, because those are two industries where it doesn't really matter how old you are. If you're good, you're right. Good. Like, you could be 60 years old and have a country music hit and right. just be like, wow, that guy's good, man. People would dig you. Same with comedy. You could start like Phyllis Diller at 47 and be like, you know.
Can you still do that in this day and age, though?
I really think so.
Like, you know, Dangerfield didn't hit it till he was in his 50s.
Mm-hmm.
It's like you said, Phyllis Diller didn't start late. But I think there's an attitude, especially in L.A., not in England. You know, I don't see it in England. When I go over there to work, you could be there could be a 20-year-old guy on stage and an 88-year-old guy on stage that's been doing it forever. And the audience appreciates the fact that it's just funny. But I think here, you get this, who's this old dude?
Yeah.
Who's this old dude on stage?
And there's always going to be the people that are like, oh, you know, this person's not going to be funny. And I mean, for example, with your look, some people that aren't really accustomed to that type of look may prejudge you and think, there's no way a guy that looks like that can be funny. I mean, I remember when I had long hair, I was at the Comedy District in LA, and these two Jewish ladies were in front. And right when I got introduced, I could hear them in front of me, and they go, oh, I am not going to like this. He's going to be awful. By the third joke, they were laughing, and I go, I knew I'd make you laugh, bitch. and that got a bigger laugh.
I think I sort of feel that same way, that feeling when I work the ships, mm-hmm. when I do the cruise ships. Because, you know, I walk around for 2 or 3 days before the shows, you know, on the ship. Yeah. And then when I first get on stage, and I go, yeah, I'm the homeless guy you saw wandering around the ship. Exactly. Because I know in their head, they're like, who's this? What is that guy? Who's this guy?
I bet you get this, too. If you ever show up at a gig that has music, they'll say, oh, you the guitar player? Are you with the band?
I get it all
the
time.
They will think you are with the band. And you,
yeah. Like, or a lot of times, like, it happened to me when I was in Skagway, Alaska. I was buying a little gift, and the guy goes, what band are you with? I go, what? And he goes, you were the band, right? And I go, no, I'm a comic on the ship. Oh, you look like a musician. Like, people just have...
Yeah.
And I think that's a societal thing right there. People need to accept...
Yeah.
We all have stereotypes. We all have pre-decisions in our head. I see you and you go, oh, you must be a musician. Oh, you must be a stoner.
Yeah.
It's not a bad thing. We right. just have to overcome, you know? Right.
And the neat thing is we get the opportunity to make people see how alike we are. That's, I mean, you're brilliant at that. When you talk about Walmart, you just opened up the door for you know, Joe Citizen to go, oh man, I know what that experience is like,
right.
you know? And that's the worst is putting out a reference that people like, hey, you guys ever see Duck Dynasty? And they go, no.
No.
It's like, what the hell's wrong with you? Everybody's seen that. Like, you know.
Well, you have to, it takes a while and I always tell younger guys this, to mold an act. Mm-hmm. It's one thing to have an act. It's one thing that it works here in Denver or it might work in LA. Take it on the road.
Mm-hmm.
the road is where you actually find out which of your jokes work.
Yeah.
Because then you go, that works out here, this works out here. And you start molding stuff right. that works no matter where you go. And I don't even know if that's a good thing or not.
And then there's like, you know, regional stuff. It's like, we're out here in the West. I'm getting ready to go to New Hampshire next week. I'm from New England. I got to pull back my my wicked pisses. I got to get, you know, I got to talk about the whole Boston thing and, like, you know, people in I got to relate to them on their level, but without sounding like I'm pandering.
Right.
You know what I mean? And at the same time, bringing what they want, which is like, give us a glimpse of the West Coast. We want to know why it's so cool.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I got to live up to that.
And as you travel, you store a little bit of gig.
Yeah.
Like, okay, I've worked the city, so I have that material when I come back.
Yeah.
You know, if I'm going to that region, I've got this that I'll pull out.
Yeah. Like, I've never been to New York City, and I'm fascinated to know just how my material would go over.
In New York City?
New York City. Hey, come on over here. Tell the freaking joke already. We're waiting. So, but what I would do is just, you know, I'd meet him on that level. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Forget about it. That's, you never say that to a stoner. Forget about it. He already did.
What is your favorite impression to do?
My favorite impression is Jim Morrison. That's my closer.
I've never seen you do that. Jim Morrison is a comic.
At the Comedy Store in the Belly Room, where I've done this for the last 12 years, doing Jim Morrison, stand-up comedian.
The same exact jokes, or just the premise?
The exact same premise, not nearly as good and as focused as mine, but it's just like, it's somewhat flattering, but it's like, wow, man, people, you gotta be definitive.
Did you track them down and say anything?
Or? I didn't, because they weren't anybody of name. But I did put out on Facebook one time, I go, this is what an imposter looks like. And then I showed 20 pictures of me over the last 10 years doing Jim Morrison.
And somebody will go, oh, that's such and such bit. That's such and such yeah. bit. And I'm like, no, I don't know who, maybe you saw somebody doing it in your yeah. little small town, but this is on a special in 1988, or this is on a CD
right.
that I did. And I hate defending myself.
Right.
Because the hard part about it for you and I both is we're not famous enough to defend it.
Right.
You know what I mean? Well, who are you? How do you know he didn't do it? Because I did it first.
Mm-hmm. And what's neat is if you define yourself so well, other people in the know will go, oh, man, that guy tries to do what you're doing. And but what I love about having Jim Morrison be the closer is – it's super unpredictable for me, and it's my only chance to go complete improv. And since Jim Morrison's a train wreck and he could pass out or uh-huh. break something, I've taken it too far. Like, I was at the Ha Ha Cafe and I spilled a plate of food and a drink all over this lady that was totally into the act. I just, like, all over her lap.
You just went into it, or you just, I
accidentally stepped on the table and knocked it over, but trying to be Jim Morrison, trying yeah. to go too far. And I've also used it in Vegas recently. I had this heckler that would not shut up for the whole show, and I was like, I mean, I tried everything on him, tried to be nice to him, and then I was like, hey, you guys like impressions? They're like, yeah. I'm like, here's my impression of that asshole at the end of the bar. Hey, I'm a jerk. I'm a real dickhead. I walk around in my underwear. I'm stupid. And that didn't work. So then I tried to get up close to him. He almost punched me. So at the end, I said, that's it. I'm giving him the Jim Morrison treatment. I came up in my very last line of the Jim Morrison thing. I took a drink out of my a glass of water, and I just walked up to the guy and drooled on him. And, I mean, that was way too far for so many people. They were like, oh, my God. It almost shut the show down. People were like, no, that's too far. That's the guy wanted to be.
No, him heckling wasn't bad. There was no reason to.
But I was in character as Jim Morrison, so I thought anything. And I go, that's my time. This is the end. And I threw them. And then when people were going, man, you can't do that kind of thing. I go, I didn't do it. Jim Morrison did. It was channeling Jim, man.
And boom, it is the end. This is the perfect way to end this yeah. thing. Now, let me wrap. We'll wrap this up by saying, how do people get a hold of you? How do they find you?
Well, they can find me on the social networks, Facebook, Instagram, Twitter. I'm rarely on Instagram and Twitter, but I'm always on Facebook too much, according to my girlfriend.
Mine too.
And that's my other girlfriend, apparently. You could see me on YouTube. I got a YouTube channel. But I do want to tell everybody, I'm super excited. I brought a copy of my comic book, Super Stoners, Dope Comics for People on Dope. I published a magazine called Cali Chronic X, which had porn stars smoking weed. They called me the Larry Flint of cannabis. Now I want to be the Stan Lee of cannabis. So I'm shifting gears. I'm doing something.
This will be the second one you're working on
the
now.
The second one I'm working on will be available August 1st at the 31st Invitational Colorado Bongathon at South Park, Colorado, and that's August 1st. So, and that's
is this for me?
That's your copy.
Thank you. I appreciate that. And you draw these yourself?
I draw these. I write them, and I portray those characters live. I mean, I you can meet the Super Stoners in person at the Bongathon, and
you have advertising and everything.
I got advertising, and I my advertisers are what keep this thing going. So I really thank them.
Well, nice. And can they get this from you?
They can. It'll be available in a limited edition exclusively at the Bongathon.
Uh-huh.
And then shortly after that, it will be in your finer smoke shops and head shops and comic book shops, iBake and things like that. So it'll be around. And then you can also see the adventures online. But this is a new wave of genre. There's actually an event September 13th and 14th called Chromic Con at the Speakeasy Vape Lounge. It's a cannabis Comic Con.
Well, you should turn this into a web series.
Yeah,
too. You could actually do a live. I'd
love to see it like Adult Swim, the style of maybe the live action Tick, or even, you know, like they used to do with the Banana Splits, part cartoon, part live action. Yeah.
La la la.
Yeah. So
love the Banana Splits.
Yeah, and what's neat is there's a whole genre of these stoner geeks, people that love the superhero comic book movies that are also cannabis enthusiasts. So
well I appreciate it. Jeff, thanks for stepping by. Jeffrey Peterson, everybody, and you will find him on the internet and at a comedy club near you. And if you follow him on Facebook, it's the 420 Comic.
That's right.
All right, man, appreciate it. Thanks for stopping
by.
Aloha, mud babies, pod people, and inhabitants of the planet Earth. It is I, your tiki leader, Steve Mudflap McGrew, back again for another great podcast. So put your rubber pants on and be ready to laugh a little bit. Laugh until you tinkle. Hence the rubber pants. All right, today I've got a comic friend of mine. Met him in L.A. Used to work at the Ice House there. He was the door guy. Before that, a rock and roller on the L.A. scene. But now a lot of people know him as the 420 Comic. It's Jeffrey Peterson. Jeffrey's going to be here with me in just a minute, and we're going to rock and we're going to roll. Hey, I hope you had a good 4th of July. I know I did. Great fireworks show. I love the ones that are free. That's right. They're my favorite ones, the free shows. This year's finale was the best ever. But again, you know, I say that every year. This is going to be the best podcast ever. And I say that every time, don't I? Here it is, today's podcast with Jeffrey Peterson.